Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
Alrighty, hello everyone and welcome to the Dealmaker Show. So today we have actually a founder that has done it so many times, oh my God, that I kind of like lost track. But incredible lessons learned along the way. We're going to be talking about, you know, what he got from timing, you know, with one of his startups. Also fixing problems, you know, and really focusing as part of that, you know, the solution that, you know, when you're bringing to market something where you've seen a really meaningful problem that makes sense to tackle. Also, what they're doing now as well, you know, they're looking at buying a competitor. So some of the things that they're looking for when it comes to M&A on the buy side, you know, which a lot of companies are using to be able to grow inorganically. And then also what he got, you know, from his first rodeo. I mean, he sold his company for $50 million. And then there were a bunch of events that unfolded after that, you know, which we're going to go into detail. But a lot of really good insights and very much so an inspiring story that we have in front of us. So without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Oli Kavanagh. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Alejandro. Great to be here. Thank you.
So originally born in Ireland, but raised in Malaysia, you know, quite an exotic, you know, way of growing up. Give us a walk through memory lane, Oli. How was life growing up?
Good, but actually it was the other way around. I was born in Malaysia and raised in Ireland. Malaysia was a British colony, and there was a transition period when they got independence. And so the UK sent out all sorts of doctors, nurses, teachers and stuff as part of that transition. So my parents were there while I was born, but I came home very early to Ireland when I was 2.5, I think it was, and been mostly in Ireland since then, apart from a few trips that I got from acquisitions where I kind of got to travel to other companies for working for tech companies.
And obviously your parents there were medical professionals. You know, one thing that's interesting is rather than going into that healthcare, you know, type of path, you decided to study computer science. How so?
Yeah, well, actually, I'd say my parents, certainly my dad, kind of talked me out of going into medicine. It changed so much during his lifetime. It became a very, very stressful and more of a bureaucratic position than what he really wanted to do, which was helping people. And so he kind of turned me off the idea. And I got interested in tech pretty early from my first computer, which was a Sinclair ZX81 in the 80s. I don't know have you ever heard of that? It was in this part of the world, in the UK and Ireland, it was the first home computer that people could realistically buy.
And I mean, it's really incredible because obviously, you know, for you, you know, it was ultimately what needed to happen, you know, for you to become ultimately an entrepreneur in the late 90s. But before you actually went at it and did so, you had to take a look at how the corporate, you know, the labor world, you know, looked like. And that's when you actually started there in San Diego at a company that ended up getting acquired by HP. So what was that experience like, you know, going through an acquisition like that? And then for you to say, you know what, I'm going to go at it. I'm going to start my own company.
Yeah, well, actually, the way that happened was, so I was with a startup in London, and we did phenomenally well during the Y2K era. We were doing IT asset discovery, which turned out to be extremely valuable for big banks when they're trying to figure out whether their thousands of PCs were going to die on Y2K. So we got acquired by a company in San Diego called Peregrine Systems. And what they did was they were only interested in the software. So they basically dropped the whole services side of the business, which was, you know, probably more than 50% of the business. And so I worked for them and I was in the US. And meanwhile, my co-founder in that company was based in London. And most of the clients in Europe were saying, hey, what happened to the services division? We really need the services division. So we could see, you know, quite a few million dollars worth of business there that was just no one was picking up, because Peregrine weren't interested. So we started a company basically initially picking up all that services business, hit the ground running with a lot of clients who had a need. They'd lost actually their services partner. And that helped us acquire an encryption tech company. And then fast forward, a company that was lining up for IPO acquired us then in 2001. And so which was an almost entirely paper acquisition. Lesson number one, try and get cash if you can. But so anyway, we had a lot of belief in this company. And what happened was, and it was a $50 million acquisition, and on paper, very small amount of cash. And the IPO date was, I think it was end 2001 or early 2002. In between 9/11 happened, the world absolutely changed, and it scuppered the whole deal. So that was big lesson number one.
I mean, talking about the risking, deal, but I'm sure that also gave you access into the full cycle of a business. What kind of visibility did that give you to into that?
It really was, because prior to that, I didn't have any of that kind of visibility of the workings of M&A and of, the kind of DD that would be involved and how a deal would be structured. Any kind of acquisition deal would be structured in terms of, cash, equity, IPOs. So I learned a lot during that process, stuff that went on to become quite valuable in later similar situations.
So then after this, once an entrepreneur, always an entrepreneur. So in your case, that was All Data Systems. So what were you guys doing at All Data Systems, and what was that thing? That sequence of events that needed to happen too for you guys to get a deal done with AutoFinder?
Well, so then, so I moved back then to Europe, and I had the desire to be a founder again after that experience. And I was actually looking for ideas, and in Dublin, so I kind of met with kind of tech founders in the Dublin area. Dublin at that point had started becoming really hot in the tech space, because all the big tech companies were moving here for their European head offices for a mixture of reasons. One is labor, another is tax benefits and that. So some of the big companies leading the way at the time were PayPal and people like that. Dublin, the European head office. Since then, of course, it's crazy. They're all here. Google, Meta, like pretty much everyone who's moved to Europe has made their base out of here. So it's great actually for the job pool. But so when I was looking for something, I was actually particularly personally interested in cars, and I had seen. At the time, SaaS type models were coming in, and I'd seen that there were a lot of different businesses, whether it was insurance companies trying to sell car insurance, publishing companies trying to sell, marketing on vehicles and things like that, insurance companies and car finance companies and the motoring websites were all trying to do the same thing, which was pay a team of people to maintain a database of all the latest cars. So every single car in the market and the price of it, the options that are available, the price of those options, images for internal and external. And it was overlapped. Every single one of these, all insurance companies had their own teams doing that research. The banks had their own teams doing it. Anyone who was selling finance and also the motoring websites were all paying their own. And I thought that didn't make any sense at all. Why don't I create a team and actually white label it as a SaaS model to all of these businesses? And so that's what we did. We built the best live database or a SaaS feed of everything automotive, and went to the banks, insurance companies, the motoring websites, and they all said, "Oh my God, thank you. This is the answer to our prayers." So they all paid a monthly fee and they let all the people go who they'd been paying to create the same database and maintain the same. And then we got pretty much the monopoly in the country. We had every B2B player who would take this information on board. And then the next phase was, okay, what do? We expand into UK, Europe, and other countries. And so whilst I was looking to do that, the main motoring website, AutoFinder, came along and said, we'd like to buy your company. And it was a fairly easy decision, because I was right at the point where I was about to take a huge risk and raise a lot of money and go out into new territories where we had no presence, no brand awareness, nothing, and start again. So it was quite an easy decision at that point to just say, yeah, okay, we're happy to sell to you. So AutoFinder bought us then, which then became part of, it was acquired by Independent News and Media, one of the biggest publishing groups here, who since have been acquired by Mediaars, which is one of the biggest publishing groups in Europe.
So then obviously, this is the second transaction that you do. You know, when it comes to M&A too, I mean, what have you learned when it comes to timing, you know, knowing when it's time to close the chapter?
Well, in that case, it was incredibly good timing. They made the approach as I was at an inflection point. What do I do? I basically got the monopoly here. I need to take a big risk. So timing there was great. But rewind, the timing of the idea was great because that kind of white label, you know, software as a service feed, this was in 2002. You know, it was kind of early days of that kind of thing. Today, it would be the automatic thing to do. You know, if I was working for a car insurance company and we needed that information, we would absolutely could just do our research. Okay, who's providing this? Who can we actually, you know, buy this information from rather than set up our own team? So that was, I suppose, good timing that I'd come back from California, which is in some ways probably a little bit more advanced, and I'd seen those kind of models. So that there was, I suppose, a little bit of luck in that. And then the other the learning experience out of that was in that exit. You can probably guess the percentage that was paper in the transaction, and it was zero.
So then for the next one, you know, around, you know, with Pliva, it sounds like the timing, you know, was off, you know, because obviously the iPhone, you know, would have fixed all the problems, you know, for you guys. But in this case, it sounds like you ran out of oxygen, you ran out of runway, and eventually, you know, things didn't unfold the way that you have hoped for. So what happened with Pliva? What were you guys doing there, and what happened there with the runway too?
Yeah, no, Pliva is you know, I love this story, and it's my biggest learning experience probably. We were way ahead of our time. Well, I say way, like 2-3 years ahead of our time. And we created the world's first mobile booking platform. And, you know, we really looked everywhere and we didn't see anyone who was doing this. And bearing in mind, this was before the iPhone. So to get on the internet on your phone, a lot of people didn't even know how to do it. You know, it was a WAP portal. How do you even get into it? We decided, myself and Frank Friel, actually, people are going to start booking things on the phone. They're gonna book a taxi. They're gonna book a restaurant. They're gonna, you know, book a massage. They're gonna book a haircut. They're gonna book whatever. And we decided that, you know, before anyone was facilitating that. So we built a WAP portal, and we basically took feeds from, you know, some of the biggest booking platforms. So we went to the biggest hostel booking platform in the world, hostels.com, and 100% of their hostel bookings were through desktop. They didn't have a mobile interface. And we said to them, you know, we think people, you know, some guy sitting in an elephant, you know, in India and hasn't booked a hostel that night is going to use his phone and he's going to, boom, book his hostel, you know, and that's how easy it's going to be. And they didn't believe us, but they said, hey, go ahead, here's an XML feed. And then, you know, so within, you know, a few days, the first ever mobile hostel booking was made, and it was through our platform, Pliva. And Pliva, P-L-I-B-A, stood for Please Let It Be Available, which we thought was kind of catchy. And then we did the world's first hotel booking, then we did the world's first restaurant booking, or maybe not the world's first restaurant booking. OpenTable, I think, was launching around about the same time. And but the world's first taxi booking, and this was obviously before Uber and all the big guys. So all of those we did, and then it was we had 52,000 different services you could book, which is one of the lessons learned from this. Do one thing and do it well. Don't try to do many different things. But we couldn't get people to use it because the internet. So this is before 3G. It was whatever 2G, if even, and it was expensive because data costs were huge then, and it was really, really slow. And people didn't know how to find the internet on a lot of their phones. So we basically, you know, we were self-funding that. We ran out of funding, and we just thought, you know, we do think it's a great idea, but it's just ahead of its time. And then the following year, the iPhone came out and fixed all those problems. And at the timing, literally, if we were 10 months later, we would have had the first, you know, first apps on the App Store doing things that are now like the biggest apps in the world. Timing is one lesson. Another one is do one thing and do it really, really, really well. Don't try to do too many things. And then there's another lesson in there as well, actually, Alejandro, which is we didn't quit our day jobs, which is kind of a sign on hindsight that we, you know, we maybe didn't 100% believe, you know, that because we had those three obstacles, it's going to be it's a real barrier to get people to use this. And I think, you know, the fact that we didn't quit our day jobs is kind of indicative of that. We didn't maybe 100% believe the market was ready for this idea. So since then, you know, one of the things that I really tell, you know, well, myself and entrepreneurs or whatever people, if you're not going to quit your day job, you know, just don't do it. I'm not going to invest in you. I'm not going to, you know, recommend anything else because you clearly don't believe it in enough. You've got to go full on 100% at whatever this project is that you believe in.
Hey guys, so pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, you know, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. You know, there's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard, and already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, you know, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors, or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, you know, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid-cap type of a cycle. So again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So with that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com. And we would love to take a look at helping you out.
So then the next stop here, you know, was Flender. Now, obviously, before Flender, you did a few stints, you know, on the sales side of things with larger players. But how does Flender come about?
So I was doing a lot of lending to businesses through a platform, a really good platform called Link Finance, which is a peer-to-peer finance marketplace for business funding. And they were disrupting, like very successfully disrupting traditional banking. Because you know, you could, you know, let's say a really good business who gets a huge order. And I'll give you a good example, like a real world example that we did. A manufacturer of food got a huge order from Aldi to go in all their stores, Aldi stores. So they had to really ramp up production. And so they had to very, very quickly, you know, so as not to lose this deal, this order. They, you know, they had to hire a lot of people and new equipment and stuff like that. And they needed like an instant 150 grand loan. And which doesn't sound like very much, but it was part of a bigger facility that they were looking for. But the initial 150 grand, you know, they went to the traditional banks and they said, look, here's the order. This is what we need instantly. We need to ramp up quickly. And all the banks said, yeah, no problem. We'll give you the money. You're approved. And they said, great. Can we have it? And they said, well, yeah. I mean, it's got to go through the steps. And when are we going to get it? Well, we don't know. I mean, it could be. We don't know. We can't give you a time. Could be 8 weeks. Could be 10 weeks. And they said that's crazy. But so they came to us pre-approved, and we could see that. And we were like, of course you're approved. So we gave them the facility within, you know, 24 hours, because we were able to disrupt them. Sorry. And so that's what Link Finance were doing. Those kind of deals, really, really instant, like very, very safe. In fact, much better default rate than the traditional banks. So they were. I was doing a lot of that kind of lending. Just with my own money through them, and earning, you know, 10-11% return, like really nice returns. They had no competitors. So the idea for Flender was to compete with them and not to take their client base, but just because the market was big enough, enough room for two. So we went out and we did that. And we created a single end-to-end platform where we were able to do what, you know, the biggest banks, the traditional banks, what it took them 10 weeks to do, we were able to do in 10 hours.
So obviously, you know, sounds like Flender was going, you know, nicely. You know, you guys, the company raised there about $5 million. Why did you thought it would make sense, you know, for you to turn page and get going with StrikePay?
StrikePay came about because of a dramatic change in that. So, like, the best problems are ones that you have yourself and that you want to, that you think, wow, no one else is fixing this. And so I saw an opportunity when the world stopped carrying cash, because I, like, during the first lockdown, so it's 4 years ago, you know, this month, I noticed that on a whole bunch of occasions I wanted to tip or pay someone and couldn't. And so at the end of the first lockdown, we got out of town, myself and my wife and the kids, and we went down, you know, to the other side of the country just to get out of the city because we had cabin fever. And we were staying in a beautiful hotel, 2-story hotel, no elevator, no lift. And I saw the concierge, was like a really nice dressed young guy with like a suit on and a lapel pin here and everything. He came over to go for our bags. And I said, no, it's okay. It's okay. I'll carry the bags. And my wife did exactly the same at the same time. Said, no, please don't. For the same reason, we both realized we don't carry cash anymore, so we can't tip the guy. Right? And we hadn't talked about it at all, but we both instinctively had the same reaction. Anyway, he insisted on carrying our bags up, 4 flights of stairs. And I said, look, I'm really, really sorry. I've no cash. I can't tip anyone. And he said, no one tips anymore.
So then obviously, you know, that thing gave birth to the company, to StrikePay. I guess for the people that are listening to get it, what ended up being the business model of StrikePay? How do you guys make money?
What we do is, so there's a transaction. And actually, the way that transaction is triggered, I'll give you an example. That concierge, he had a lapel pin. There's a reason I mentioned that, is because I was thinking about it that night. And I sat down and I listed 12 occasions where I wanted to either tip someone or pay them and couldn't. And I just thought, you see that lapel pin? If it was something like you could tap your phone on and it would tip him, whatever, $5 or something. That was the kind of the dream that I had. And I asked him the next day, I said, you know, if I could tap that and would tip you $5, would you like that? And he said, God, that'd be amazing. Of course, I would love that. And so I started then thinking, okay, there's nothing in the world that you can do that. There's no personal portable payment terminal. You know, and every kind of concierge and bartender and server in the world isn't going to go out and buy their own Square terminal, for instance, right? And anyway, it's too big and clunky. So anyway, I started thinking of ways of creating something small enough that you could just tap to tip, and they're small enough and low cost that we could sell it for low cost, but also we would survive on the transaction fees. And that's the model. So we have devices that we give, you know, thousands of employees of, you know, thousands of businesses where they can either carry a physical thing, which is so small, it's like the size of a lapel pin, and people tap it to tip them. Or in many cases, it's just a QR code. So we created, you know, scan to tip, and that's very successful. And that's very scalable, and we don't have to charge for that at all. So we're actually able to give a free product. So you can create your instant activation QR code. So I can give you your own essential tipping terminal or payment terminal that'll be working within 30 seconds. So it's the world's only instant activation payment terminal in that sense. That's what our patent protection is around, actually, that instant activation. So where we survive then is in a monthly SaaS fee to each active user who's actively getting payments or tips, plus a transaction fee. And we're doing pretty well. I mean, the transaction fee, we're making typically 6%, you know, which for a payment company is insanely high, you know. Most payment companies would be very lucky to make 1%. So the reason we're able to make so much on it is because people aren't really price sensitive when it comes to this kind of transaction. And also in, you know, 95% of the time, the person who's actually making the payment is covering the fees, which keeps it, you know, nearly free for the actual user, for the for the employee, let's say in a salon or a hotel or, you know, wherever it is, the guest or the customer is covering those transaction fees. Either way, if they don't, they can opt out of covering them. And if they don't, either way, we still get the fees. So that's our business model.
So now, when we're thinking about the vision here, you know, imagine if you were, because obviously you've raised a little bit of money. So I guess the you've raised a couple of million here for the company. But obviously vision is everything, no? And that's what investors are betting on, customers, you know, your employees too. So if you were to go to sleep tonight and you wake up in a world where the vision of the company is fully realized, what does that world look like?
Yeah. Well, what we've done, I mean, if we lean on or play to our strengths, which is, you know, that area that we have the patent protection on, is we literally can give everyone, and actually our target audience, you know, initially 60 million people in the, you know, UK and the USA who rely on tips. And with all of those 60 million people, we can give them their own tipping terminal, personal tipping terminal, and we can have them all set up instantly. So where I wake up is all of those 60 million people are tippable through StrikePay. We can do that at no cost, no setup cost for them, and no cost to us either, because that's scalable solution that we have. We could onboard the 60 million people, you know, at very, very low cost. So we don't believe there's anyone else in the world who could do that.
So obviously you've now been creating companies since the late 90s, Ollie. So if I was to put you, you know, into a time machine and bring you back to the late 90s, and right before you were making the switch, you know, from Peregrine Systems to start your first company, you know, if you were to be able to go there and give that younger Ollie one piece of advice for launching a business, what would that be and why, given what you know now?
Okay, yeah, that's interesting. I would do a couple of things. One is, you know, I'm able to do it now, which is nice. I actually would have been able to do it then, actually, but it is to build your proof of concept and have it revenue generating before going out to raise funds. And because for the first few companies that I on that path that I founded, we did the opposite. We basically went out raising money on a brochure. And I think if you can self-fund it to a proof of concept that actually is, you know, works as product market fit and is revenue generating, then there's lots and lots of benefits from that. It's much easier to raise money. You get better valuations. You get less dilution. You also have more belief in it, you know, that you're actually seeing it working. You're truly, truly passionate and believe in it. And that's what myself and my co-founder in StrikePay, Charles, did. So we self-funded StrikePay, that initial product, which actually looked very like that concierge tap-to-tip thing that I said to you. So we built that, filed global patent protection on it. And on day one, we gave it to 200 delivery drivers for, it's kind of like a DoorDash type company, but it's called Just Eat. I don't know if you've heard of them, but they're the, yeah. We gave it to them and said, here, guys, try that. We basically gave them a bucket of 200 of these things here that I'm carrying in my hand, which, you know, your audience can't hear, but it's a small, like a really small key fob where you can tap it. And it gives a tip to whoever the person is. We basically gave them a box, said, give that to your guys. We don't need to know who they are. And what they did was, the drivers then, when they started their shift, were told, hey, if you want to get digital tips, because people don't carry cash anymore, take one of those guys, tap it, and activate it. And so that's what they did. The drivers took one each, tapped it, activated it. And then when they went to their first delivery, the customers said the same as they had all been saying for the last few months, which is, oh, sorry, I don't have any cash. And they said, that's fine, you can tap that. And overnight, we doubled their incomes.
Wow.
Yeah. And then, only then, did we go out and raise money.
I mean, that traction, you know, and that leverage always helps when you're raising money, Ollie, that's for sure. So I guess for the people that are listening, that would love to reach out and say, hi, what is the best way for them to do so?
Well, they can email me, ollie@strikepay.co, or just go onto our web. If you just Google StrikePay, it's all one word, S-T-R-I-K-E-P-A-Y, you'll find us at strikepay.co. You get us on Instagram at StrikePay, and Instagram's quite popular for us because we have a lot of users in the hair and beauty space. So we'd be the leader in hair salon tipping, beauty salon tipping, and that. So that's where you find that audience is on Instagram. They can we're pretty easy to find. Just tip, digital tipping, StrikePay, and we come up top. We're the leader in this side of the pond. and aim to be the leader in the US as well soon. We're starting a trial in 10 states with one client who's in thousands of locations. And so we reckon pretty soon we'll be in thousands of locations across the US.
Amazing. Well, hey, Oli, thank you so much for being on the show today. It has been an honor to have you with us.
It's been my honor. Thank you so much, Alejandro. Great talking to you.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers Podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening, and see you at the next episode.